Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Peter Gaiman, professor of Old Testament and Biblical Languages at Shepherd Seminary. This podcast is dedicated to discussing issues related to scripture and theology. For more information, visit petergaiman.com.
Well, happy Thanksgiving to everybody, and I hope that you're able to enjoy it with friends and family and just give thanks for everything that God's done in our lives. It's just really important to be observing that, and as Romans 1 talks about being the opposite of the unbeliever who turns their back on God, refusing to give thanks. So as Christians, you know, we have this great not just privilege, but, you know, opportunity to thank the Lord for all that he's blessed us with. And so don't forget to do that. Well, today we are continuing our series on the Marxism critical theory, critical race theory, which we began last week. So if you missed the previous episode, you really need to hit that because it provides a lot of the foundational realities for moving into what we're going to see in this episode. And to kind of just give a little bit of a link between last episode, what we talked about specifically was that Karl Marx had theorized that there would be this natural revolution, which was brought about by the oppressed in society, which ultimately led to this utopian state. The class system would be destroyed. Ultimately, he believed the family would be destroyed. There wouldn't be any usefulness to having this class distinction. But his ideas never succeeded, and so you had Gramsci and other neo-Marxists who then shifted their ideas to an emphasis on dismantling the Western culture because they viewed the culture as what was holding back that natural revolution, which they said was going to take place and was going to come. And so you had the Marxist disciples then linked with the Frankfurt School, who were advocating for this destruction of both Christianity and Western culture because they were viewed as being linked. And the means by which they were going to accomplish that was, as Rudi Deutschke said, the, quote, long march through the institutions, unquote. In other words, the whole goal was to infiltrate the churches, the media, the schools. And once you're able to do that, then you're able to change the culture. You're able to change the way that culture thinks and therefore allow the pathway through which socialism can come into the United States and Western culture. And so that was the game plan. And that's kind of where we left off in talking about the connection between Marxism and critical theory. And one of the things I guess I need to say about critical theory as well is that critical theory was essentially the part of Marxist doctrine which advocated for the destruction of society. It was the tool by which you can destroy something because you can analyze it with the intent of change and destruction, dismantling, and then ultimately paving the way to rebuild something new. So that is intrinsic to the Marxist idea, to the paradigm as having the critical theory, which is a destructive influence. So I started this whole series off with the idea that in order to understand the culture around us, when we look around, you know, it seems kind of odd. Some of the political correctness that's out there, the cancel culture, how are we to understand these things? And I said there were three things that we need to understand. So Marxism is a huge one because that has a huge influence in the universities and media, and it's starting to have influence in the churches now, unfortunately, which is why we're doing this series. But then you also have critical theory, which we talked about both of those last time. And then I said the third item, which really helps us understand, is the idea of postmodernism. Now, postmodernism has, and we'll define it in just a moment, but I will say that if you look in the past 50 years of the church's existence, there have been quite a few church leaders that have dealt with postmodernism. You had MacArthur writing on it. You had Moeller writing on it. You had Francis Schaeffer writing on it. You know, you had all these top name individuals, pastors, theologians talking about postmodernism and the difficulty and danger that it poses to the church. And so postmodernism has been dealt with before in detail. However, postmodernism for many people has been viewed as kind of fading away or self-destructing. And so it wasn't really viewed as much of an issue. However, there is some leftover influence, some vestige influence by postmodernism and its combination with critical theory and Marxism. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. So when we think about this, by the way, I should make a note here that one of the best books that just came out on this, and I'm heavily reliant on it for some of the cultural analysis, is a book entitled Cynical Theories. It's entitled Cynical Theories with the word critical is crossed out. So it looks like it's titled Critical Theories, but critical is crossed out. And then above it, it's written Cynical Theories. And the subtitle is How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why This Harms Everyone. And this is a book written by two individuals, Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay. And I can't recommend the book highly enough. I will say that it is not written by Christians. These are two individuals. I don't know as much about Helen Pluckrose, but I know James Lindsay is a very active atheist, very unashamed and active in the atheist movement. He is a very brilliant man, but he is completely and unashamedly an atheist. Now, Al Mohler interviewed him on his podcast, Thinking in Public, about the book. And that was about, maybe 3 months ago or so. I think it was in August, if I remember correctly, August or September. The book came out in August. And so it's really well done. It traces the history of postmodernism, critical theory, how it influences the critical studies that we see in academia today. And by the way, one of the interesting things about Lindsay and Pluckrose and one of their other friends, Peter Boghossian, I think it was 2 years ago, they had a little experiment and they submitted a couple pseudo articles to these top gender studies journals and critical journals, and they just made stuff up and submitted it to try to show that that academia today has no concern for process or methodology. All that they're concerned with is the coming to the right conclusion, that is advocating for, you know, feminism or gender equality, things like that. And so they did. They got like 9 articles published, and one of them was made, given this special award and everything like that. And then they came out saying, hey, listen, everyone, all this stuff is just completely bogus and made up. Nobody bothered to fact check this stuff. And so what they did was they just blew a huge hole in academic studies, saying, listen, nobody is concerned. In fact, one of their papers, all they did was they took Hitler's Mein Kampf and just changed a couple of the words around, and they published that in a journal. And so it's, people could have easily found that, you know, even in just copy pasting what they had written in a Google search engine, for example. So it's, some people don't really like these authors, but say what you will about them, they are definitely cutting edge, and they like to show some of the problems with academics and academia as a whole and how that goes. So they do an excellent job analyzing some of the modern innovations and the problems with it, even from a secular worldview. And so I've taken a lot from their analysis, and I think that there's a lot that we can glean as Christians from that. So I wanted to point you to that resource. James Lindsay also has a really good website, New Discourses, I think it's called, New Discourses, and he does a lot of stuff with critical theory and analyzing the problems with critical race theory and other critical theories on there as well. So that's a free advertisement, I suppose. I'm not getting paid to do that. I did buy the book. I wasn't given it for a review. I think it's valuable enough to make that purchase. And so I commend that to you. All right. So when we think now about postmodernism and its influence on society, let's work with a definition here. So the way that we can define postmodernism, and this is taken from the Encyclopedia Britannica, postmodernism is a late 20th century movement, largely French in origin, and it's characterized by broad skepticism, subjectivism, and relativism. So this would include a general suspicion of reason and an acute sensitivity to the role of ideology in asserting and maintaining political and economic power. So that's, again, the definition from the Britannica Encyclopedia. And what I think is really helpful in that definition is this idea of skepticism. Whenever you think of postmodernism, you want to think of skepticism and this relativism. In other words, it's the objective truth claims, the correspondence theory of truth, has no place in postmodernism. There's a skepticism that we can't actually know things, we're influenced. And then we also, in that second part of the definition there, we need to be sensitive to the fact that the cultures we're a part of are just imbibed with this ideology of political and economic powers. So that is a foundational reality for postmodernism. Now, when you think about the main principles of postmodernism, there are two, and here again, relying on Lindsay and Pluckrose's work as they've studied this and looked through this, I think they do a great job. And they kind of boil it down to two principles that define postmodernism and then four themes. So you can kind of encapsulate this postmodern teaching into two principles and four themes. And I think when you kind of understand this and compare it with the postmodernists, the philosophers and things like that, it really starts to show, okay, yeah, there is definite postmodern influence in even the activists of today as they're marching on the streets and things like that. So the postmodern knowledge principle and political principle would be the two main principles here. So the postmodern knowledge principle is a radical skepticism as to whether objective knowledge or truth is obtainable and a commitment to cultural constructivism. So what that means is there's obviously doubt that objective truth is possible. Anybody who claims to have access to objective truth doesn't know what they're talking about from a postmodern viewpoint, because that's not possible. Rather, you would have a commitment to what's called cultural constructivism, or sometimes it's called social constructivism. And basically what that means is that our access to truth is dependent on our participation in certain societies or cultures. So that's what it means by this social constructivism, is that your society, your social location, is constructing your truth, as it were. Now, how that plays out is ultimately, and this won't be a surprise to anyone. Well, it may be actually, because if you haven't studied this, you might not have heard this, but it's very common in media, as well as just like those graduating universities, to proclaim the seeming universal truth that no culture is superior to another. All cultures are equal, because that relies on this principle here, this knowledge principle that we have this commitment to this societal or cultural constructivism, meaning that how we view the world is influenced by what part of society we're in. And so, like I mentioned, the correspondence view of truth, the correspondence theory of truth, which teaches that there's an objective truth and it's established by corresponding that to how things actually are in the world. Well, that's rejected. And instead, then there's no objective real truth per se, but rather you have these influences of the different parties or cultures, if you want to use that term again, are that you're a part of. That's what's influencing you. And so that is a central component to postmodernism. And certain postmodern philosophers, one who's very famous, Michel Foucault, argued especially that societies and cultures construct what Foucault talked about as a discourse, a way of talking about things. So even the language that we use, like gendered language, for example, talking about men and women is a societal construct and doesn't necessarily have a basis in reality. And so it's really kind of interesting, because the whole takeaway then And we'll talk more about this later, but the whole major takeaway of postmodernism then would be that you have to have this skepticism of even how things are described and talked, the language that's used, and you have to destroy those systems in order to, you know, get rid of this cultural hegemony, this one-sided power. And so that leads us to the second principle, which goes along with that, and that's the political principle. So the postmodern political principle is the belief that society is formed by systems of powers and hierarchies, and those systems, those powers and hierarchies are what decide what can be known and how. So on the one hand, society, if you think about the knowledge principle, society and culture dictates how you view things, the things that you can know. And then the political principle teaches, understands that this society is actually constructed itself by powers and hierarchies. And so you kind of have to deconstruct that in order to know what's going on. So in this view, again, Michel Foucault talked about this, other postmodern philosophers as well, you have power and knowledge. They're essential, that they are absolutely entwined, to these ideas of knowing. And so I think it was Foucault actually who deemed this as power knowledge. So it's not just knowledge. It's not just the idea of coming into knowledge of something. It's actually totally dictated by power itself. So it's not actually possible to view something objectively. You're viewing it through society. But then the society itself is not necessarily neutral. It's being controlled by powers and hierarchies. So there's always something or somebody that's controlling this. So one of the things that Lindsay and Pluckrose point out in their book is that a central belief in postmodern political thought is that these powerful forces in society essentially order society into categories and hierarchies that are organized to serve their own interests. Now, I quoted that from page 37 of their book, by the way. And if you think about that principle there, that these hierarchies, these powers organize society in a way to serve their own interests. I'm going to put the cart before the horse just a little bit here, but I think you'll understand this. This is where the whole idea of white privilege or racism comes in today even. And we're going to talk more about this later, but just for now, by way of illustration, for somebody to say that, for example, the United States is racist or something like that. Well, this is what they're arguing ultimately from this postmodern political principle, is that they would argue that the whole society has been constructed by these white men. And so the system itself facilitates to white men. And this hierarchy has been in control for so long. They've designed the system. So we need to destroy the system because it's a system inherently of white privilege and racism. That's what they would argue. And I was just reading some anti-racists this week, and they literally said that. And that's why it's so important to know this worldview, because you can just identify immediately why they're saying the things that they're saying. And the thing is, they don't need to, in their mind, they don't need to prove that, because this is a worldview issue. It's assumed that this is true. Remember, when we're talking about worldview, a worldview is something that's assumed to be true without having to prove it. And so remember that you have a lot of people walking around society that are assuming that the way that knowledge is gleaned, that knowledge is determined, is just a symptom of culture. It's just a consequence of whatever culture you're a part of. And they also believe that there are certain cultures, like the American culture, for example, that are inherently racist and systems of powers and hierarchies that specifically skew the way that knowledge is disseminated and known so that it benefits certain people. So that's a very important understanding. And so obviously the implication for an activist would be that you need to destroy that system. And that is the greatest good that you can do, is destroy that system to get rid of the advantages that the system gives to certain people. And then you can ultimately be ensuring justice. That's what the social justice movement is all about. So obviously, as even as we're talking about this political theory and understanding how it relates to postmodernism, then the one thing that's going to come up over and over again is that there's this incredible cynicism or negativity that's at the heart of culture today. And part of that is because of the postmodern influence, the critical theory influence. Like this is something that people are internalizing, and it's just incredibly negative because they view everything through that paradigm of oppression, oppressed, and they assume that there are these societal constructs which are negative and they oppress people. And so You need to understand these postmodern principles, the knowledge principle, the fact that truth is not objective. And then you also have this political principle being that, you know, there are powerful people and systems that are designed to advantage one group of people, for example, over others. And so that's helpful. Now, here's a good quote by Lindsay and Pluckrose as they kind of summarize this. They say, throughout postmodern theory runs the overtly left-wing idea that oppressive power structures constrain humanity and they are to be deplored. This results in an ethical imperative to deconstruct, challenge, problematize, that is to find and exaggerate the problems within, and to resist all ways of thinking that support oppressive structures of power, the categories relevant to these power structures, and the language that perpetuates them, thus embedding a value system into what might have been a moderately useful descriptive theory. Now, there's a difference there with that quote. I would say that that's a difference between the atheist worldview and the Christian worldview, where they say that this might have been a useful descriptive theory if it was just utilized as a description. Obviously, we would say this is completely worthless because it starts off with the foundation of an anti-God worldview. And so we understand that there is no benefit to these constructs, these ideas. If you want to say positive outcome in using this, that is possible because you started off on the wrong foot. I mean, you were trying to fly to Florida and you wound up going to Russia. You know, this is not something that is going to be beneficial at all for you. And so Pluckrose and Lindsay are emphasizing the fact that the problem comes in the activist mentality saying, hey, because this is wrong, we need to change that. Well, from a Christian worldview, we would go one step further and say, well, you started off in entirely the wrong area, and there's not even going to be any benefit from coming from these ideas. So it's important to know this from a worldview perspective, but obviously we would be a little more bold in our critique of this postmodern idea. So those are the two principles of postmodernism. You have the knowledge principle and the political principle. And now we kind of get to what we could decide are four themes of postmodernism. And these aren't necessarily less important. They're just more readily identified as the means by which postmodernism works through society, or it's really how it works out in everyday life. So there are four of them. So the first one would be what Lindsay and Pluckrose describe as the blurring of boundaries. The blurring of boundaries. So what that's talking about, and again, reliant on the French philosophers of postmodernism here, is this idea of if we assume that truth is relative to cultural viewpoint, if we understand that, then we would understand that how society defines boundaries is not necessarily black and white, or it shouldn't be viewed that way. So there's a natural suspicion then by all postmodernists of these boundaries and categories, where they might be viewed as accepted as true in previous generations. Now you have this understanding that, hey, we don't need to accept these boundaries as true. A really classic example right now would be the LGBT communities, for example, pushing the boundaries of, well, first sexuality of, hey, you know, marriage does not need to be between one man and one woman. That is an antiquated idea, a societal, cultural idea, which is gone with the wind, as it were. We don't need to understand things that way anyway. That's a very antiquated morality, outdated. So we can push on that boundary. Something else would be just the idea of sex itself, male and female. That also is not a boundary that needs to be observed. I mean, you can go down the line with all these different examples, and this is a evidence of postmodern push, postmodern philosophy at its outset. On a very interesting level, you have pushes that are done in fat studies, for example, is one of the areas. And Lindsay and Pluckrose talk about this in their book. And it's really kind of interesting because whereas, you know, we've for so long heard that, you know, obesity is the great killer, you know, it's really unhealthy for you to be obese. Well, some of these studies are pushing back on these ideas then and saying, well, now just one minute, like, who are you to say that somebody who is a little heavier than traditionally we have thought that they should, that's okay, because these boundaries are not to be identified with such hard lines, and it's natural. And so they would argue along those lines. So the blurring of boundaries is a very significant push as part of the postmodern idea. Along with that, then, you have the second theme of postmodernism, and that's the power of language. So in postmodern thought, language is basically, I mean, it's viewed as having the integral power to control society and how we think about it. Therefore, it's inherently dangerous. So if you think about how systems are described and how they are defined, well, even thinking about the boundaries themselves, the way that we talk solidify those ideas. So for example, just the very fact that if I go to a group of individuals and I say, hey guys, what's up? Well, the fact that I used guys to describe this group of individuals, well, that is solidifying, reinforcing a hierarchy view of knowledge that is antiquated, that you know, should not be used. And so the language that I'm using is reinforcing gender stereotypes, et cetera, things like that. It's supporting the male patriarchy. So according to this idea, you need to pay special attention to the discourses that are used, the language that's used, the way things are described and talked about. And then you need to deconstruct those. You need to change the language. You need to take intentional steps to do that. That's why in postmodernism, deconstruction is so essential. And so in Lindsay and Pluckrose's book, they say, consequently, since discourses are believed to create and maintain oppression, they have to be carefully monitored and deconstructed. This has obvious implications for moral and political action. So in other words, part of the way that activists need to, you know, grab the bull by the horns, as it were, and proceed is to identify these languages, these phrases of oppression. Let's again put the cart before the horse and say this is the whole concept behind quote unquote hate speech, right? So hate speech is a postmodern offspring saying that it's not just about communicating hatred towards somebody. You could communicate hatred to somebody with the most pleasant words possible. That's not the issue. The issue is that if you say something like, oh, I believe homosexuality is wrong or something like that, well, you committed a hate speech crime because your words are constructing a society. They're supporting a society which needs to be torn down. That's the issue here. And so paying attention to language, the power of language is essential in a postmodern viewpoint, and language needs to be carefully analyzed and deconstructed whenever it supports a system, which is, obviously undesirable from the viewpoint of whoever is, operating. So the third theme of postmodernism then would be cultural relativism. So this is so key, by the way, because when you think about truth and knowledge, they're believed to be constructed by the society, and they're maintained by these dominant discourses and these language games that operate within the society. And if you're a part of this society, you can't step outside of your society or your culture, and therefore you can't actually have a external vantage point to look at these things. That's why the idea of cultural relativism, it's really identifying the fact that we are products of our culture. And so we need to destroy the culture in order to be able to have a better, viewpoint. So first of all, I would say from a Christian viewpoint, and we will try to talk more about this in the future, but from a Christian viewpoint, it is absolutely ridiculous to argue that all cultures are relatively synonymous and there are no morally superior cultures. I believe, if I remember correctly, I did write a blog post on this about how all cultures are not equal. And we just obviously would understand that our argument is based on the fact that there is an objective standard of morality, but for a postmodernist, there's not. And so again, remember, this is the reason we need to understand this viewpoint as a worldview. Because with this understanding of cultural relativism, not only is there this argument that all these cultures are equal and that we are products of our cultures viewing it that way, but it goes even beyond that. And this is really, I would argue, one of the foundational ideas of the concept of intersectionality, for example, where you have, for example, if I were to try to speak on racism, which ironically I kind of am in these podcast series, if I'm trying to do that, what I would be accused of is that I don't have the capacity to understand or to speak on it because I am a straight white male. Therefore, I'm a part of a culture which embraces racist ideologies. And so I have no capacity from within my culture to speak on that. I'm blinded. And so it's a lose-lose. There's no way to win because the assumption is that because I'm a racist already, because I'm a part of the racist culture and because I'm a part of the white dynamic, then I have no capacity or wherewithal to be able to talk about those things. And so this cultural relativism then is so key to understanding why, you know, everyone's so upset with the old white men and why being white is such a big deal, because when you're part of the dominant, color group, as they would call it, you don't have the neutrality, as it were, to be able to view these things. You are defined by your culture, and that's how you're viewing these things. And so the natural outcome of this would be that criticism from any position deemed powerful would have to be dismissed because you're either ignorant or you are by definition serving your own interest. So you can't win, because if you are in the powerful group, you are either automatically assumed to be ignorant or biased, or what you're doing is ultimately trying to further your own self-interest. So there is tremendous negativity, tremendous cynicism in this worldview. And so the assumption of this ends up being so detrimental. So that's cultural relativism. And let's not miss the fourth theme here as well, because I think this plays out in so many different ways as well. What you have in addition to the three previous just listed is also in number four, the loss of the individual and the universal. So based on everything we've been talking about, the idea that you can have an autonomous individual, or how we would often call them, a free thinking individual, that's a myth. It's not possible for this worldview, because the individual, like everything else that we've talked about, is a product of their culture, a product of the society, a product of the language games, the language, the discourses that have been constructed around this individual. And so as you think about that, you recognize that, okay, yeah, if you know, try to fit yourself into this worldview. Yeah, if I'm assuming, remember, you can't use a biblical anthropology. That's not possible. This worldview does not, it's completely antithetical to the Bible. It cannot coexist with a biblical anthropology or a biblical theology, knowledge of God or a knowledge of man. So these things can't work together. Now, some people try to get them to work together, but that's inconsistency. And it ultimately ends in disaster. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about critical race theory in particular, because many in the church have tried to implement these ideas. But thinking through this concept itself, the individual is a product then of their society, a product of the way that language has that's why even you've heard this phrase as well, silence is violence, that whole concept, right? Well, that's because if you're silent instead of speaking out against these language barriers or so societally constructed hierarchies, well, then you are complicit in supporting that. And so that's the whole concept of that. So the postmodern view then loses the individual, because the individual is just a product of the culture. Like if you were, which by the way is wrong, inconsistent, because there are minorities who would agree with white individuals, for example. There are there's lots of inconsistencies to this viewpoint. However, the way they get around that is saying that these individuals, the minorities, they've embraced the dominant power structure, for example. And that's why the culture, the systems, are viewed as the main antagonist. And the systems need to be destroyed, because those are the ones that are facilitating and deceiving people into those ideas. So not only is the individual lost, but then also, kind of ironically, in this postmodern view, you also reject the largest viewpoint, the universal, the humanity. So instead of saying, okay, get rid of the individual. The individual is just a product of their society, and we're dealing with these small subunits. But also, there is no common humanity now, because you are only a product of your culture or your small sphere of influence. So there's nothing that would, like in the Christian worldview, for example, the image of God ties together every human of every single ethnicity on the planet. But there's no unifying factor within this postmodern viewpoint, because it all revolves around these miniature groups. And again, this feeds into this idea of intersectionality, where, you know, you are not an individual who has all these unique experiences. No, you are a part of this group. You're a part of the ethnic minority over here. You're a part of the LGBT community over here. You're a part of the feminist community over here. So those different communities, those different groups, are what define your knowledge, values, and discourses. So it's really kind of sad, because you remove the individual, but you also remove the basic humanity. So if you think about this now, because we're starting to, I think, see some of, if your imagination is going along with me here, you can see how a lot of this works out in the everyday, activist approach, the calls to defund the police, because the whole system upon which the police is formed is racist, and the system and the hierarchy there needs to be destroyed, because you can't just fix one problem. You need to go overboard and destroy the entire system, right? Those are logical outcomes of this worldview. Combining it with critical theory, the Marxist outlook, these are how they work out. Now, this is the huge takeaway for this understanding of postmodernism, is that people thought that postmodernism died, or at least like became irrelevant in one sense. And the postmodern activists really began in the 60s, and then they ended up stalling in the 80s. Like postmodernism was great, but it didn't really provide the juice, as it were. And so postmodernism started to lose its attractiveness in one sense. It actually kind of carries with it this idea of self-destruction. I mean, you deconstruct everything, all of a sudden you're left with nothing, and then you die unhappy. So in one sense, postmodernism really didn't have much of a healthy existence. But in the 80s, and again, Lindsay and Pluckrose do a great job of talking about this, tracing these kinds of things. You have the activists, these social activists and whatever, combining the principles and the themes that are found in postmodernism that we just talked about, they juice it up with this Marxist critical theory. So they now have this hybrid of critical theory ideas along with postmodern worldview concepts. And so the result from the 80s onward, and you really hit a fever pitch post 2000, so that since 2010, you've just seen incredible things that just would be unimaginable 10 years ago. And so you have this I call it this evil child between postmodernism and critical theory now, where you just have these hybrids walking the streets literally and implementing these things day in, day out. And along with that, you don't have strict postmodernism and you don't have strict critical theory. It's this hybrid. And one of the major differences in today's postmodernism as it's played out on the streets of everyday life with the graduates from universities and whatever is this. According to postmodern principles, you have the knowledge principle is this skepticism about whether objective knowledge or truth is obtainable, etc., right? Well, postmodern principles have evolved slightly today in that everything remains true, essentially, with the major exception that identity and oppression based on identity are objective realities that are known. So, in other words, they're presupposed to be true. So let me say that again. So that everything largely remains the same, except that your identity, your group identity, your oppression that is a result of that identity is treated as a known objective reality. So in other words, those are the foundational realities that everybody assumes to be true. So we'll talk more about this in the next episode specifically with regard to critical race theory, but I think it's a good example here. So for example, the anti-racist critical race theorists will say it is not a question of whether racism occurred, but how racism occurred in this situation. Now that's crazy if you think about it, because what they're saying is that we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that racism is actually taking place in this situation. It doesn't matter. Like, we know that that is the objective reality. That is the objective truth, that racism is taking place here and that it's negative. So the only question is, how is it taking place? Let's look at the details and figure it out. So that's literally the major change. And that is not a healthy change at all. This whole system is completely devoid and bankrupt of all morality anyway. But now when you add that, think about every single individual that's walking the streets, assuming that somebody is being racist toward them, assuming that they are being oppressed because of who they are as a oppressed people group, as a LGBT, as a Hispanic, as a Black. You know, that is what they are being taught. That is on the university level. These are very common teachings. So now you have this concept being brought into this evolved postmodern principle. It's evolved like a virus. Pluck Rose and Lindsay say. And so it becomes very, very unhealthy. In fact, I have a quote here I want to read from their book on page 46. They say, "We might think of postmodernism as a kind of fast evolving virus. Its original and purest form was unsustainable. It tore its hosts apart and destroyed itself." That's kind of what I talked about with regard to just how it deconstructs itself and it couldn't exist. But they go on and say, "In its evolved form, it spread, leaping the species gap from academics to activists, to everyday people, as it became increasingly graspable and actionable, and therefore more contagious. It mutated around a core of theory to form several new strains, which are far less playful and far more certain of their own meta-narratives. They are centered on a practical aim that was absent before, to reconstruct society in the image of an ideology which came to refer to itself as, quote, social justice," end quote. So this is, this is one of those elements where I think, you know, even an atheist can see this idea where you have social justice, you know, we can talk more about this in another episode as well, but the whole concept of social justice, it sounds so good because coming from a biblical worldview, we like the terminology of justice. Who doesn't? I mean, God is a God of justice. And so who would not want to be a part of this idea of justice? And yet, we need to understand that the idea of social justice is not, I mean, those who would hold to social justice, the social justicians, as the guys from the Just Thinking podcast would call them, I love that phrase, the social justicians, as they would utilize this, they reject completely and without apology the Bible. Yes, absolutely. In fact, they would say that the Bible, as being part of the foundation of the United States, is a racist book. So this whole concept of social justice is not related to scripture. In fact, it's dependent upon these ideas of critical theory, of postmodernism. And so the ideas of justice in their mind is to tear down the class structure, to tear down these hierarchies, to tear down these class distinctions, these meta-narratives, in the words of Lindsay and Pluckrose, which are supported by the language themselves. And so that is their idea of social justice, to promote equity in the sense that we tear down everything to make everyone equal, regardless of the consequences, regardless of the context. And so those are incredibly dangerous ideas that skate by under the term social justice. And so we need to be very, very cognizant of this worldview and think through that. So next time we'll look more in detail at one of the specific critical theories, and that would be critical race theory. There's a lot specifically we need to deal with regard to that. It's very dangerous, but it's one of the most common ones that are known. So I think it's a helpful analysis, and that's kind of what started this whole series. So Lord willing, we'll do that next time. And I've really appreciated all the feedback that I have heard from you on the podcast episodes, especially last week. So thank you for reaching out or stopping me and just talking to me, telling me about the episode and how it's encouraging you. That's encouragement to me, just knowing that this can be helpful for others. And that's the whole goal. And I pray that the Lord does that day in, day out for his church. You can always reach out to me through my website. I have a contact form there, petergaiman.com. You can always visit the shepherds.edu website to look at Shepherd's Theological Seminary and find out more about that as well. I look forward to next time. Until that time, may the Lord bless you and keep you and make his face shine upon you.